Oh, boy. That's some stunning stuff you got there, Ned.
Thank you.
My name is David Ganz. This is KPFA's Grateful Dead Marathon for 2001. We're going to be on the air until 1 o'clock in the morning. My guest is Ned Lajan, who was the piano player on that session, along with David Crosby on electric 12-string, Jerry Garcia on electric 6-string, Phil Lesh on bass, Bill Kreutzmann on drums. Do you remember what guitar Jerry was playing in that session, Ned?
Sorry, don't.
Yeah, there's several people in the chat room are asking questions and some comments I'd like to ask you
about. I may be able to recall that later on as I work through the cobwebs. Remember, I was only 8 years old when I was playing.
That's right. He hadn't even his bar mitzvah yet.
Nope.
And there he was at Aces with all those musical heroes. Right. Karen Hicks says her 10-year-old son loves the Seastone tapes they have from the live shows you guys did in Marin County in 75. And her 10-year-old son calls them whale music and thinks it's good music to think to.
Uh-huh.
I happen to agree with him, by the way.
Well, I'm very gratified. First of all, there is a relationship to whale music there. And that is, Seastones was a piece that started out compositionally with me in 1970, and it had a lot to do with a number of issues. It's a process piece, and by that I mean there's more than one version of it, and in fact, in 1972 there was an acoustic version with all the same players on it. It reflects a lot of feelings, some of them frightening, from Vietnam, and from what was going on, as I said, when I met the Grateful Dead at the same week that the Kent State killings occurred. But it also has a lot of transcendentalism in it, particularly the last section, and a lot of what a lot of interspecies communication thoughts and feelings, particularly whale music. And the little story that goes with that is that David Crosby, once again, after he had heard the initial work that I had done on Seastones in the early 70s and had already done some of his work, he brought to me a record that had come out, a Song of the Humpbacks with Roger Payne, who was a biologist who was recording the humpbacks. And we sat at David's house and listened to that often and thought about it. So I'm very gratified to hear that people still remember that and that that kids are thinking about it. Of course, I went to MIT, and so music to me is everything from dance and sex and music and fun, but it's also something to think about. There's all different kinds of music, and it should stimulate all different parts of your body and your brain.
I've often characterized Grateful Dead jams to people who are wondering what it's all about as really good music to think along with. And one of the things I sort of came up with earlier this year in a conversation with somebody was that the songs themselves were provocative enough. A lot of Hunter's lyrics were vague and sketchy and suggestive rather than assertive, and it would give you something to ruminate about when they went off into these jams. You know,
oh,
it was
absolutely
very good music to philosophize with.
I think as I was telling the story of how I met the Grateful Dead, one of the reasons that my friend pushed me towards the Grateful Dead was that there was not only things that we were doing that musically, stylistically, rhythmically were happening, but there was a process that we were going through that allowed that openness. It allowed that openness of interpretation. Much of the personality of the audience on any given performance could be included in some sense subliminally or overtly in what was going on in the music, and that was one of the beauties of the Grateful Dead. It was also one of the things that they had to occasionally suffer through. In fact, being as sensitive to the context, the environment within which they were playing and who they were playing to and what they were playing about.
Now, I remember Phil or Jerry, I forget which, talking about when you guys were in Europe doing this stuff, that one of the audiences, maybe in Germany, was whistling, which was a sign of disapproval where they came from, but that you and Phil sort of played along with the whistling and played it right back to them. Do you remember that?
Well, again, I need to say two things about that. One, just backing up to the whale music and the recordings of Seastones. One of the unfortunate things about Seastones was that it was recorded at a time when the technology, particularly the magnetic tape, but even the amplifiers, could not handle the sound. And so, for example, when I played on stage, I had the ability to play a chord on stage and lift the entire PA as if it were a seismic event. Phil and I were able to play subsonics, as was Jerry, and those could be felt, but they, the tactile part of music. But those could not be heard and those could not be recorded. A surround sound, it would be interesting to remix some of Seastones in surround sound with today's technology, because The original record that was released was actually released in quad, and when it's flattened into two-dimensional stereo, you miss the three-dimensionality of the sound taking place. The concert in Munich was very interesting because, once again, like Vietnam influencing Sea Stones, there we were in Munich just a few months after, in the Olympic Hall, a few months after the Olympics and a few months after, or maybe it was closer to a year, but within a short period of time of when the athletes had been killed by terrorists. I'd never been to Germany before. I'd been to Europe, but Germany was, for me, an interesting place to go and see what was going on. It's true what you've heard, that German audiences, at least back then, showed their disapproval by whistling. And what occurred was that we were playing to a hall of about 6,000 or 8,000 people, and particularly in the front, there was a group of people who were very into the music. But in the back of the hall, there was a group of people who were very much not into the music, and they started whistling. And they all tried to get together in the back whistling. And this is thousands of people now potentially trying to whistle in tune, in harmony together. And so I tuned into their with my synthesizer. I tuned into the same frequency that they were whistling at, and then modulated it both up and down, which basically took what I considered at that point the regimentation of the population. There was some resonance with German history, and fragmented it. And lo and behold, to my surprise, at that point, the entire audience was basically won over and enjoyed the rest of the performance. But as I said a moment ago, particularly with the Grateful Dead, that interaction and understanding with the audience and feedback with the audience was critical to me. It was critical to Phil. It was critical to Jerry, and it was critical to the entire family.
Now, a fellow on DeadNet who's posting here in the chat room, or maybe it's in the conference, said that he was at the show at Roosevelt Stadium in August of 74, which I played on this program a few months ago, and said that you and Phil scared the bejesus out of him.
Well, I'm laughing. I'm not surprised. As I said, some of this music comes from the Vietnam War, and it comes from other deep, psychological and psychic sources, and it's meant to do that. There is music, if you go back to things as classically cliched in a sense today as Wagner, there are things that were frightening to audiences when originally played. Some of Stravinsky's music caused people to riot and throw chairs at the stage, as did, hard to believe, Debussy. I can't do the quote exactly, but calm the savage breast. Well, it also can inflame the savage breast. It can also bring back some memories, collective unconscious memories that may evoke fear. Mountain Girl used to tell me every time she saw me, she'd bring up the same thing. She'd say, when I play Sea Stones, there's a point when I think that people are breaking into the house or driving up the road, and it frightens me. And then something else translates that into a different space. But she remembers the effect that it had on her, and it has nothing to do with overtly what the sounds that she's hearing. It has to do with the emotions that are at play in her heart and mind.
Interesting. On a similar note, my wife and I were out record shopping a couple of weeks ago, and she picked up one of the Coltrane of the Village Vanguard CDs, and we listened to it when we went to bed. And I was almost, I was in that place where I was just asleep. It was almost a lucid dreaming place. And something about the saxophone solo just jolted me right back into wakefulness. And it was this cry, this incredibly intense emotion of sort of suffering coming out of this. I think it might have been the My Favorite Things jam.
Well, I was very lucky to have grown up in New York, and from the early 60s on, before I was able to drink or drive or anything, to go to the village, to go to New York and hear a lot of this music. And I spent half my time during the days at the Museum of Natural History or the Museum of Modern Art, and half my time in the jazz clubs listening and meeting all these players. And Coltrane, even when he was playing things that were still relatively melodic, tonal, and rhythmic, My Favorite Things, for example, had the cry of the slave and the cry of the beast and the cry of pain. The whole black avant-garde jazz movement affected me greatly. That's Archie Shepp and Cecil Taylor, and again Coltrane, and of course Ornette Coleman, and many others. And when I had my jazz program on WTBS in Cambridge when I was going to college before I started broadcasting live from the jazz workshop. A lot of the music that I played was from the black avant-garde. People need to understand, again, from the Sea Stones perspective, that that's a lot of what was going on in the 60s that went into a lot of people's music, that they felt that they needed to respond to their environment, whether it was the burning of the cities or the war that was going on or the civil rights struggles that were going on. And it set music free. And that, to my knowledge, really hasn't occurred again since that period of time. But it set the stage for a lot of the people and a lot of the things that you hear today. A lot of that music is still around, notwithstanding Ken Burns and the show on TV. That music has been assimilated in some way, and those feelings are still there. And it's, as I said before, it's gratifying to hear that people still remember Sea Stones, because Sea Stones, in my mind, was and continues to be a part of that period, and to express those emotions.
Another now the Sea Stones CD or album that came out on Round Records in 74 was reissued on Ryko Disc in 91 with some additional music. One of the other comments that came in over the net was he should put out some CDs.
First of all, the record, the Round Record release in 1975 came out at a time when the Grateful Dead were moving from Warner Brothers and then through Round Records and Grateful Dead Records to eventually United Artists. And just a few weeks after that record came out, we were transferred to United Artists, who really didn't have an understanding of Sea Stones. So the first pressing was somewhere between 14 and 20,000 LPs, and that was sold out, and then it was never really replaced in the stores. Ryko approached me, I guess around 1990, and with a very limited budget, they wanted to re-release the album. So the album was not remixed. A second version of Sea Stones was added, but a lot, maybe five or six times the length of that CD of material, much of it more minimal and more tonal, has never been released. In addition, there was one fatal flaw in the Ryko release, which was the sections that were clearly delineated, the seven sections that were clearly delineated on the LP, were mastered down in LA, but never appeared on the CD. So the CD appears as just two tracks, one very long Sea Stones and one shorter Sea Stones, and which is unfortunate because there are several sections. And as I said, it's a process piece. So it was meant, the order as it was in performance was meant to move around as a Calder mobile. Huh. And so now you have the technology in CD players to play at random or by choice these modules in different order. Unfortunately, the CD is not mastered that way. So it's my hope at some point in time that we release that music and release other Sea Stones music, that some of which is more tonal, some of which is more minimal, and some of which is more accessible, and some of which is less frightening. But to release a lot of the music, and to remember this, the music that we're listening to tonight is a result of musicians, including John Cipollina and David Crosby and others, coming into the studio to do more work on Sea Stones type material that was never released. Some of it was used as performance tapes at the Palace of Fine Arts and at Dominican College, but much of it has never been used. I think the person in the chat room was also interested in whether this music would be released, and I have thought about that, and we're going to think about how to do that. I would like to release it with the profits going believe it or not, a cat charity, or a feral cat charity. I lost, he passed away a few months ago, a cat of only 8 years of age, who taught me a whole bunch about grace and gentleness and dignity and courage. I adopted him as a feral cat. He was a totally wild animal. I kept a cage in the living room as a jail when he misbehaved. He was raised by squirrels, believe it or not. He would climb trees up and down like a squirrel, not like a cat. He loved acorns. But by the time of his passing, and actually long before then, he had taken on a character that was far different from a feral creature. He was, he had, as I said a moment ago, the grace and dignity and courage and gentleness that makes him one of my heroes. And while I don't want to talk too much about cats, I've been thinking recently about releasing this birthday music of mine in his honor, and having the profits go to a feral cat charity.
I'm guessing there are a lot of people that would happily support that effort.
I'd like to mention one more thing. I have been a recluse for many, many years. In fact, this music hasn't been played for 26 years, and maybe David and I will talk a little bit more about that later. But the way that David and I bonded was when I was telling him one of my other cat stories, which had to do with me buying a house so my other cat would have a home and a house rather than an apartment. David said to me one of the reasons he got his house was that his aging cat would have a backyard to play in, and that instantly bonded me with him. The cat is the surface issue. The heart, David's heart is the greater issue. And I think for you who are dedicated listeners to his show and have heard him perform, I hope that you understand by now who he is and what he's all about. I only learned that recently because I only started interacting with you recently.
I'm dumbfounded, Ned. I think we need to move on.
Okay.
There's another piece of music here from the same birthday tape.
Yes.
This is on my list as Ned's number four. What would you like to say about this one?
Very quickly, this is more of the jam music laboratory, us playing for the sake of sort of playing licks off of, and rhythms off of each other and phasing those. It's, again, based on the changes, on the out changes to Homeward Through the Haze, a David Crosby tune again, and as I said, would be part, as I envisioned back then, of a jazz / Seastones melodic suite, a George Gershwin-esque Seastones suite. So this would be the basic material. If you heard this in what I had imagined the final form to be, it would be rather different. There would be reasons to release both kinds of material. But as I said, today you're hearing just the raw material, and it's Homeward Through the Haze, the outchanges, same cast. And us just playing, and I'm reminded of one of the things that you like to talk about, David, and that is collective improvisation. Here, the background and foreground, the lead and the backup are blurred a little bit more. The levels are a little bit more equal because we're actually all intertwining. This is an example of taking certain rhythms and just weaving them together into a cloth, again, into a surface, into a topography or a topology, rather than playing a tune or playing backup to a lead line or a song line.
You're listening to Ned Lajan, and he's playing some music from his personal collection that has not been heard by anybody since it was made on March 17th, 1975, his birthday, at Bob Weir's recording studio with David Crosby, Jerry Garcia, Phil Lesh, and Bill Kreutzmann, along with Ned, who's playing the piano. Let's listen to this. Another 8.5 minutes of very interesting music. Thanks for bringing it in, and thanks for being here.
Sure.